We're all in the process of change. We're all in the process of change all the time. We can focus on that process or deny it, but it's going on all the time. And I'd like to talk about change just for a couple of minutes. Can you all hear me all right? Great. I'm sure many of you know the story, but it's a lovely image of the farmer whose horse runs away, and his neighbor comes up and says, "That's too bad." And the farmer says, "You never know." And the next day, the horse comes back being followed by a beautiful wild stallion. And the neighbor says, "Aren't you fortunate?" The farmer says, "You never know." Soon after, the farmer's son was taming the horse, and he got thrown from the horse and he broke his leg. The neighbor came along and said, "Isn't that too bad?" And the farmer said, shortly thereafter, the Cossacks came through conscripting young people for the army. But because his son had a broken leg, they passed him over. And the neighbor said, "How fortunate." And the farmer said, About 2 months ago, my friend, a colleague, my partner, actually, in spiritual work, Jai Lakshman, who some of you have heard sing and met, he lives in New Mexico, and he called me and he said, "You're going to be out in New Mexico for the Bhandara, the spiritual gathering. On Sunday, would you consider playing in a golf foursome on Monday?" Now, I had last played golf maybe 25 years ago. I think since then I had been once on a driving range. And I thought about it, and I realized that all three of those golfers were basically good golfers. And I said, "Sure." So that one statement, "Sure." Instead of, "Will I?" Sure. The next week I started lessons. And I got this wonderful woman, Susan, as my teacher. So I brought my clubs out that I had stored and carried truck after truck after truck all these years. They were actually some of my father's clubs. I brought them out and she said, "Oh, you can't use these, they're antiques." Okay. She said, "They make clubs longer now." After we had been studying for about 2 weeks, I took lessons every other day and then practiced on alternate days. She said to me, "Well, Richard, we're going to try something new, but I've got to ask, have you ever heard of meditation?" But we've progressed a long way because she's taking her PGA tests next week to be a professional in the golf circuit. And I've been training her in meditation. So, I worked really hard and I went to New Mexico and I played golf. And I had a great time and it was beautiful and good exercise and fun and incredible. And I came away from that experience feeling very vibrant, vital, like I had taken on a new task and I had brought unconscious habits to consciousness, seen the wrong habits, shifted to new habits, and we're putting them back into the unconscious now. And of course, it surprised people. They'd see me out in the Gulf Coast. They'd say, Ram Dass? Like, they just caught me in a pornographic movie or something. What are you doing playing golf? Are you voting for Bob Dole? So then, as Jackie told you 2 weeks ago, right after that experience, when I was riding high on that, I came to give a lecture in Denver with a stage like this, and I went to leap up at it, and I didn't leap enough, and I hit the thing with my shin and fell back on the floor and hit my hip and got up smiling, hugging people, you know, just like, until I felt this blood in my shoe. And just as I was going to speak, in fact, they were introducing me when I became aware that there was a sloshing quality in my right foot. So I stuck a napkin in there and sat with a napkin over me so they couldn't see the blood and gave my lecture. And the next week, which was last Friday night, I was down in Santa Barbara, and I came out in the dark, going back to my cabin at this place, and I looked up at the sky, and I wasn't familiar with this place, but I made a wrong judgment, and where I thought I was going up a place, and there was going to be a walkway, there was actually a stone embankment going down 6 feet, and I rolled down this embankment, and ended up upside down, and got up, and I couldn't turn my head left or right, and I had this big bruise on my behind. Poor behind, it already was suffering from the last one, and you should see it. It's the most technicolor vision imaginable. You've never seen one like it. It's an art form, a new art form. So my whole image of myself shifted because people said, you accident prone? Or, I think you should watch your step. Or they'd say, look before you leap. Or, you know, they would start, everybody started to be cute, the way you deal with older people. So I went from being this golf macho, you know, everybody's saying, God, that was a great shot, you know, to being, here, let me help you on the steps. It took 1 week, you know. And I saw that if I put my chips in that particular pot of self-image or physicalness, it was going to be a rocky road. There's no doubt about it. Getting rockier as the years go by. And yet things keep changing all the time. Things are as unpredictable as the swish of a horse's tail, the Buddha said. And the interesting question about change is, where can one be in relation to change so that it doesn't generate fear? Because what I experience in the society at the moment is I don't want to put it in a negative terms, I'd say, but I'll say it first that way, a breakdown of systems, a breakdown of social mores, a breakdown of family structure, a breakdown of economic equity, a breakdown of our environments, our air and our water, and a breakdown of our technology to deal with it, all this stuff. Breakdowns of the stability that came from having an enemy, strangely enough. Breakdown in who's got the bomb. And breakdown in our immune systems. And breakdown in our ability to control violence, that we have more people in the prisons of this country than in any other civilized, proportionally than any other civilized country in the world. Yet we're the leaders of what? Are we the leaders of imprisonment? And you and I are dealing with all that, somehow or other. And it's interesting, the question of what toll that's taking on us. What are we doing about our hearts? What are we doing about the nature of suffering? What are we doing? How are we dealing with all that? Not only is it all changing, but it's changing in a very uncertain way, how it's all going to come out. Just the last weekend, the reason I couldn't leave, even though in Santa Barbara, even though my neck couldn't move and I was sitting on ice, was that there are some wonderful people in this little study group, including this fellow George Stephanopoulos, who works with Bill Clinton. And when we were going around the table asking the questions about what we would like to be thinking about the future, he said, I'd like to think about why what to do when governments don't work. And that's coming from an extremely decent human being. Extremely decent human being. A very compassionate guy. So you and I have this interesting predicament that we're here, really, with Eupsychia, with some kind of a model that we are part of a consciousness evolution, that there's something happening to us, that we're awakening in a certain way. But the predicament is that transformation is change, and change often isn't the changes you expected. In fact, if you expected them, they wouldn't really be changes. That's what's so far out about it. There is an element of surprise in growth, as you can ask any person entering puberty. I never thought baseball cards wouldn't be valuable to me. So I asked myself, so the Buddha said, in talking about three basic things of the nature of existence, of this kind of existence, one of them was anicca, meaning change, meaning all form changes. I mean, if it's rocks, it may be slow till it gets worn down, till sand, and then into petroleum, I don't know how it goes, but whatever it is. There are different rates, but everything is changing. So if you want to stand somewhere, the predicament is wherever you're standing is crumbling, basically, at one level or other. I mean, if you stand in your body, you're growing old and going to die. So if you're identified totally with your body, you're really up the creek without a paddle. Because if you're standing on something that's going to change, and it's going to change the nature of who you are, it is almost impossible, if that's who you think you are, not to experience fear. If you look at the sequence of development, the developmental sequence, and see us being born, taking incarnation, coming into body, coming into this spacesuit, which we don't know how to run. We're like, ah! And then we learn how to do that and all that sort of thing. And in the process of learning, we develop a conceptual map, a definition, a computer software. It's called ego. It's a structure, it's a model, a map we have in our consciousness of who we are and who everything else is and how it all works. And in that model, you are somebody. You are that time-space person. Now, you didn't get born that way, by the way. You got born with innocence. I mean, you were seeing colors and patterns. You didn't see man, woman, mother, father. You didn't see me. You didn't have all of that's all learned stuff. Put the patterns together. Now, isn't it too bad that before that, part of your perception was innocent in the sense you saw everything. It didn't mean anything, but you saw everything. Then to add meaning, you started to not see things. Is this too weird? Or are you? Tell me if it gets too weird. This is the stuff I think about. What the hell? And when I looked at, and I reflected back, if I came into my body and I was this really old lama that had just taken rebirth to come and bless everybody. So I'm in this little body. Wah, wah, wah. You know, and I'm just like, I'm in this spacesuit I haven't figured out how to use yet. But I'm this old, I'm this old lama, see, way in there. And you know, when you look in kids' eyes sometimes, you know they know, but you, well, you know. So then my mother and father, who definitely thought they were somebody, their little baby boy had been born, their third son, Richard. And I went into Richard training. And if everybody around you treats you like you're real, after a while, the sense you're not loses its potency. It's interesting that when you're surrounded by people who have one reality, it is very, very hard for you to entertain another reality without defining yourself as psychotic or being defined as psychotic. I remember when I got thrown out of Harvard for psychedelics, there was a press conference and there were all these movie photographers and news people, and I had just been thrown out of Harvard, the first professor in the 20th century or 6,000 years or whatever it was. And they all saw me as this incredible loser. I mean, I had taken on Harvard University and lost. And you don't take on, in Boston, you don't take on Harvard. I mean, Harvard is Boston. And I saw in their faces the fact that they thought they were photographing a loser. The problem is that I experienced that the integrity with which I had acted was absolutely true to my most inner being, and that I was right. And I thought, I was a psychologist. I thought, this is psychosis. Can you see how I think that? I mean, I could look in all their eyes. They said, nuts, 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 you know. Sicko, sicko, you know. Too bad, too bad, too bad. And I'm thinking, I won. And it turned out I did, you know. I mean, that's what's so far out. They were wrong. Simple as that. They missed the boat. I mean, Harvard was, by the way, absolutely right to throw me out. I would have if I were in their role. Because I was like going onto a tennis court with football cleats. You know, you don't go into a temple to the rational mind and bring in chemicals that make the rational mind only relatively real. So we got born into somebodyness, and we went into somebody training. That's the way I see socialization now, somebody training. And once we mastered somebody-ness, so they were sure I'd be Richard, who they expected I'd be. And I had forgotten anything else I had known. Then I went into somebody special training. You all did too. Now, if you are in the somebody special business, and to train somebody, you use reinforcement of some sort or other. I mean, you use smiles or loves or something. It might not be behavioral rat pellets, but it'll be something you use of, my mother used to just frown, you know, and that would be enough. But in order to play that game out, you are somebody special in a relative reality, so you're special within a context, and so you need people constantly be telling you how special you are. So you're hooked into a network of other people's consciousness, continually. It says you're somebody and you're somebody special. And by them knowing somebody special, they become special. So everybody gets kind of a reinforcement out of the game. The predicament is you're very, very vulnerable under those circumstances. Because all that could change in a second. You could lose your job. You can fall off a stage. I mean, within a moment, it all could change. And you're no longer the somebody special that you were before. Now, that kind of interactive web of consciousness, so that we know who homeless people are, we know who has a home, and we know who's this and that, and everybody dresses accordingly to their identity. And there's tremendous redundancy in the amount of information we give each other about who... Everybody's walking down the street saying, this is who I think I am, this is who I think I am. This is who I think I am. Hey, this is who I think I am, you know, or... Everybody's got one. Hey, man, this is who I am. This is who I am. This is who I am. And we enter into these conspiracies. I'll make believe you are who you think you are if you will make believe I am who I think I am. And, I mean, that's really the social reality we live in, actually, which is absolutely off the wall. I mean, we're all totally mad. And how do you break out of it? How do you break out of it? How do you realize you've been had? Isn't that interesting? How does that happen? Well, in the spiritual jargon, it's called awakening. You awaken to realize that the channel you've had your television set tuned to turned out to be only one channel, not the channel. You were like the English with the BBC some years back. But yeah, that's all they had. Turned out it was good. Wish we had only that. And if I trace what goes on in people correctly, I see that that training into individualism, into being somebody and somebody special, is ultimately incredibly alienating. It cuts us off incredibly from everybody else because we lose some kind of a balance. We keep getting so busy becoming somebody special that we step over everything, all of our support systems, in order to become more special. I mean, I grew up at a time, like in the 60s, where in the 60s, the spiritual awakening justified leaving the family, certainly. Now, if I grew up in Mexico or Guatemala or Nepal or India, I wouldn't think of leaving my family. I wouldn't think my personal growth could justify my saying, hey, everybody, see you around. But I think I was part of that sickness. That sickness that said, we have been living in a kind of a Victorian and a puritanical world of a kind of an imposed morality that suppressed a lot of stuff in us as individuals, needs and desires. If you read 18th century literature, you feel all that and the burning tensions underneath. And the 60s and the 50s, the Beats and the hippies and all that, everything started to open up, and the civil rights movement and the sexual freedom movement and the environmental movement and the women's movement and everybody said, I'm not being heard enough. And we went hell-bent the other way. We got really fascinated with our own individualism. Who am I? Am I getting enlightened? Are you fulfilling my needs? I'll fulfill your needs if you'll fulfill my needs. Very strongly identified with needs. The whole political structure went over to rights instead of responsibilities. Instead of what's the common good, we flipped over into what do I need, what do I want. And the predicament happened in our society, at least it seems to me, that what we've called the American dream turns out to be dysfunctional mythology. And we got caught in it. It's a kind of a 1940s dream. It's once the Second World War is over, once the righteous war is over, because we're righteous, then we will have an increasing GNP and everybody will have more material comfort and we will all be happy. And what interests me is how many of us played that dream and then got sufficient affluence, relatively speaking. I mean, we're all like kings and queens in this country, even the unemployed, even the homeless live better than the people I live with in India mostly, or Guatemala. We got what the dream promised, and we saw those that got more of it on Dynasty in Dallas. And somehow, we realized that was not going to give us the happiness. It didn't feel good inside. And part of why it doesn't feel good inside is because it is uses denial so much in order to make oneself feel adequate and good. Because we are standing on the top of a mountain. It's like the game Top of the Mountain, King of the Mountain, Queen of the Mountain. And as the north-south economic disparity gets greater and greater, and that has happened very dramatically in the last 20 years with the trickle that didn't trickle. That you and I, in order to enjoy the luxuries that we have, often have to not think about other people in order to have those. And the cost of that not thinking is not nothing. It's not nothing. Because what I experience is that when I have to look away from what is, there is a way in which I have to harden my heart or veil my heart with a rationalization, with a thought web to protect my heart. Because you can't look at the news with your heart open. You can't look and walk down the streets of a major city with your heart open. Or can you? Because our predicament is that if we close our hearts, we're closing ourselves off from the kind of life juice that comes from being in the world. We start to armor ourselves. We live in those little villages with a security gate. And then do we feel safe? Do we? I was in Guatemala. And I was with a group of villagers we're working with up in the Altiplano. And these villagers had their villages decimated by the government army, who's trained by the USA, by the way. These are all Mayan Indians I'm talking about. Because the Mayans wanted to have their own land. Because all the land's owned by about 4 to 6% of the people. And so they were called communists, and the Americans trained their army to kill off the communists, who were the Mayan Indians. So they killed all the men and boys. So the women were left with the babies off in the jungle. And then they came back to these villages, and we've been helping them with sheep and goat projects and water projects and helping them become and government structures so they can do it all themselves. We ask them, what do you want from us? Not, what is it we want to do for you? We're not that kind of development people. And we form very deep friendships with these people. It's very frustrating to have them have nothing and have us have whatever we have and realize whatever we have isn't enough.
And there's great teachings. Here's just one little teaching, and this is a digression. But at one point, we found 13 villages that were almost starving. And we had already gone over our budget. And we conferred at the Seva Foundation that we started, that works there, that I represent. And we decided, we said to this woman from one of four villages, we will take on your four villages this year, but we can't take on the other nine until next year, because we don't have the money. And she said, you don't understand. The Topol Vuh, our holy book, teaches that if you're walking along and somebody stumbles, you help them up, and then everybody walks just a little bit slower. So we'll divide the money among the 13 villages, whatever you give us. That could have meant that her child would die, by the way. But it was deep in them a sense of that if you take something for yourself and push away other people in order to have it, it's not maybe worth having. The cost may be too great psychically or spiritually or consciously or something. So at any rate, here were all these old villagers, women and old men and babies. And they were all frightened that the rich people's army was going to come in and kill them. And I happened to fly from there to Hollywood, to Los Angeles. And I was staying in Brentwood, in fact, on the same street, the next house to O.J. Simpson, it turned out. This was prior to this, many years ago. And you know what that street looks like now. I'm sure everybody does by now. And in that days, there were no people on it. There were just big walls with television cameras and gates. And on every lawn, there was a sign in black and red that said, Armed Response. And I realized that here were the rich people hiding behind their walls, afraid of the poor people. And I had just come from where the poor people were afraid of the rich people. It took 3 hours to get from one place to another. You can feel a destabilizing force. You know, I grew up where I never took the key out of the ignition of my car. Never locked my house. I still don't, but I never did then. Now I don't, and I'm considered a weirdo. So the fear has increased. And the fear is rooted in that individualism, in our sense of separateness, because we feel very vulnerable, because each of us as individuals is very little, and the systems we're surrounded by are very vast. They're like mob violence, or they're like weather conditions, or they're like economic movements, they're things we can get caught up in a second, and they can just crush us. They can turn your IRA into wallpaper. And the usual pattern of response to fear is contraction. You contract. And when you contract in your mind, you define more rigidly the boundaries between yourself and other. And you do that with prejudice and opinions and attitudes and judgments. And so bigotry and prejudice go up. And ultimately, as we're seeing in the Middle East, and we're seeing in Rwanda, and we're seeing in Europe, Eastern Europe, and we're seeing in North and South, ultimately violence result. Fear, contraction, prejudice, violence. Violence, more destabilization. Now, let's just say, just for speculation now, because few people ever say this. Let's say this is all the way things are, and this is all going to happen this way. Where are you going to be in that whole process? Are you going to be one of the people that contracts, that gets more rigid, more prejudiced, more violent, as your place, your space, your identity gets threatened more and more? Or is there some quality in you or some way of being inside yourself, and we'll see what all that means in a second, some way of being that allows you to view change with the kind of a allowing of it instead of a reaction against it. How many of you are feeling yourself at peace with the prospect of change? Change means your body's going to grow old. Change means things might get much worse than they are. Change means there may be less to go around. Your standard of living may change. Lots of things may happen. Let's just say, I'm just playing, it'll be harder to breathe the air, the water will be worse. The immune systems will break down, more people will be dying. Let's just take, go. I'm not a ghoul, I mean, believe me, I'm not. But I'm saying that most of us respond to that stuff through denial. We just close down and we don't want to look at it because, and I'll tell you, to the extent that you do not stay open to what is, your decision making is abominable. And your opportunities to therefore optimize the experience of life and grow from it gets reduced. So if you see that sequence and you're asking what's our part to play, then you see that that issue about awakening becomes very critical. Because they say in a world of blind people, the one-eyed man is king or the one-eyed woman is queen. It's just an old phrase. I don't even like it, but it conveys the idea that is there a relative place we could stand that would allow us, like when Mother Teresa is working in the gutters of Calcutta picking up lepers who are lying in their own vomit and feces and urine, and you look at her and you think, what a courageous, wonderful woman she is. But interestingly enough, if you ask her what's going on, she says, I am serving my beloved Jesus in all his distressing disguises. Now just imagine that she's not putting you on. That's the reality she's living in, just for a moment. Consider the fact that in her perception, this is the beloved she is serving. She's not serving an old, dirty leper. In other words, her vision has shifted so that she is functioning on a different plane of consciousness than you are when you look at her and say, what a courageous act that is. Is this too weird yet, or are we here together? No. What happened to me historically was that after I awakened, and I did that in 1961 through the use of the psychedelic mushroom, the psilocybe mushroom, or Tiananactl, called the flesh of the gods in Mexico by the Curandera. And I saw in the flash of a moment, it took me that long to realize that I had been had. That I had bought into a system that defined reality in a way that was strangling me and everybody else in it. And in a moment, whatever that chemical thing that happened in my brain, it overrode probably at the synapses or something, the chemical patterning of my habits of thought, so that instead of seeing the world in my habitual way, I overrode those habits and saw it freshly. And saw what had been foregone in order to make my impoverished habits function without any threat to them by defining everything that wasn't part of those habits of thought and sensation and perception as irrelevant or error or static or interference or something like that. I mean, many of you know that you have gone into other planes of consciousness and that you've come back from those planes and the conceptual structures you had in this culture to define what those were either kook or pathology or better not tell anybody or...